I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Flanked by metal workers on one side and members of his administration on the other, yesterday President Trump ordered tariffs on imported steel and aluminum effective almost immediately.
Today, I'm defending America's national security by placing tariffs on foreign imports of steel and aluminum. We will have a 25% tariff on foreign steel and a 10% tariff on foreign aluminum when the product comes across our borders. It's a process called dumping, and they dumped more than at any time on any nation, anywhere in the world, and it drove our plants out of business, it drove our factories out of business, and we want a lot of steel coming into our country, but we want it to be fair, and we want our workers to be protected, and we want, frankly, our companies to be protected.
He gave Canada and Mexico a temporary reprieve depending on how NAFTA negotiations progress. This announcement was rejected by many in the GOP. House Speaker Paul Ryan said more should be done to narrow the policy on those countries that actually violate trade law. We asked Heather Long to join us. She is economics correspondent for The Washington Post to help us fill in on all these details. Heather, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good to be here. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you. This decision seemed to surprise, even shock, some members of the White House. Was this the president essentially acting alone?
Almost alone. So there's a couple of theories about why he did this. Obviously, as you said, he was flanked by workers. This has been part of his mantra to protect these industries really since the 1980s at the Washington Post. We went back, we looked at some of his earlier writings and speeches from the 80s and early 90s, and it sounds almost verbatim today, this talk of we need to protect our workers from foreign dumping from Asia. But I think there was a little bit more involved here. And in particular, politically speaking, when he decided to do this, think about what was going on. We had that terrible, horrible tragedy in Parkland where the gun debate, which was not going well for him, was taking over. We had questions about his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and whether he was not doing a very good job in the White House. Those were some of the main stories in the news. Of course, we had the ongoing fallout from that Rob Porter, the former staff secretary who was accused of abuse by ex-wives, and debates over whether Chief of Staff John Kelly was going to make it. And so in the White House, that Peter Navarro, this very conservative trade advisor who wants to see these tariffs enacted, took that moment to walk into the Oval Office and sort of present Trump, say, now is the time. Let's divert the media. Let's divert the attention. Let's get this that rally your base by doing these tariffs. And that seems to be what Trump did.
Well, he clearly did, and he apparently has the authority to do it. Let me ask you, though, a bit about steel and then also about aluminum. We import about, I think, 25% of the steel that we get into this country. And I'll just read off the number one country in terms of the share of U.S. steel imports. We'll start with Canada, that's 16%, followed by Brazil, South Korea, Mexico at 9%, then Russia, Turkey, Japan, Germany, Taiwan, India, and China down at 2.2%. When the president talks about dumping, is he talking about Canada dumping steel or China?
It's a little bit confusing, I agree, because when you hear dumping, you think, okay, that sounds like there's literally boatfuls of the steel and aluminum coming from China directly to the United States. And that's not really what's going on. As you noted, we're getting the vast majority of the steel and aluminum we get from Canada and the European Union, and as well as other allies. But what's happening is, and in particular in 2015, China, to get out of their great recession, their problems there, they had a massive real estate boom, which fueled their need for steel and aluminum and these components. So they built up that industry even more than they already had. And in 2015, the government pulled back in China on some of the real estate development. So they had a lot of extra steel. And what they did is they, quote, dumped it on the world market. So even if it didn't go right to the United States, it caused prices around the world to crash. So if that Chinese steel was going to Europe or if it was going to South America, you know, there was just a glut on the world market, similar to what we saw with oil prices that fell that year. And that's what really, really hurt United States steel and aluminum, which were already in a long-term decline. But when you talk to workers and when you talk to CEOs of companies, I mean, I'm from Pennsylvania, when you talk to U.S. Steel out there in Pittsburgh, they will tell you 2015 was rough, almost went out of business. They froze worker pay for 3 or 4 year contracts. That was what the tipping point here.
Well, and talking about aluminum, we apparently import about 90% of aluminum in this country. And the president talked about imposing a 10% tax or tariff, although a tariff is a tax, on aluminum imports into this country. What do you see the impact on that? And I guess the larger question is, will these tariffs bring back these industries?
It's going to bring back a little bit. I think what the easiest parallel to what we see now, you know, people are talking about trade war fears. The reality is we're not in a trade war. We're in what you might call a trade spat. Because he exempted Canada, which is our number one supplier from abroad of aluminum and steel, because he exempted Mexico, now there's the word flexible was said more times than I can count yesterday. It looks like they'll probably exempt parts of Europe and Japan, among others, as this process rolls along. The reality is it's not going to have as much bite as what we were initially all very fearful of. And because of that, this looks to me a lot like what actually President George W. Bush did back in 2002 when he did a steel tariff. The reality is there was a very small hit to the economy then. It wasn't noticeable. And there were some job losses in what we call the downstream industries, so the folks who are using that steel or aluminum to make car parts or make appliance parts. But honestly, it was very negligible overall. It's considered a net negative, but it wasn't something that sunk the economy. And that's probably what we're going to see here. This is more of a political leverage at this point than it is an economic one.
It's interesting because Peter Navarro on Sunday was saying there would be no exceptions. And as you mentioned, Canada, Mexico, part of NAFTA, there certainly is a temporary carve out for them. But the president seemed to also be saying it depends on what we come up when we renegotiate NAFTA. Does that put pressure on Canada and Mexico?
Oh, that's definitely part of what he wants to do here. And think about it, not just Canada and Mexico, but all these other countries that want to get exemptions. Japan is really upset about this. So is the European Union. They have to come now to D.C. They're actually supposed to be meeting in D.C. on Saturday already to talk about some of this stuff. And they kind of have to come to us, right? They have to come to the United States, come to the Trump administration and beg for an exemption. And Trump likes that. He likes to feel like he's got the power in the upper hand. And so this is definitely, in that sense, ticking a box and playing into how he would like to potentially do some leverage on these deals. But the reality is he keeps talking about wanting to shrink trade deficits. And economists will tell you, I think your guest later on will debate some of this. Yes. That's not going to happen because of this.
Oh, interesting. And I will pick that up with our guest. Let me play something that the president said yesterday. And this was about Gary Cohn, who resigned. And we can talk about whether it was a result of this decision about tariffs. But first, let's hear what the president had to say.
This is Gary Cohn's last meeting in the cabinet and of the cabinet. And he's been terrific. He may be a globalist, but I still like him. He is seriously a globalist, no question. But you know what? In his own way, he's a nationalist because he loves our country. And where is Gary?
Thank you, sir.
You love our country. And he's going to go out and make another couple of hundred million, and then he's going to maybe come back. He might come back, right? We'll be here
absolutely
another 7 years, hopefully, and that's a long time. But I have a feeling you'll be back. I don't know if I can put him in the same position, though. He's not quite as strong on those tariffs as we want, but that's all right.
So, Heather, what was the president saying there yesterday?
He was saying that you did a good job for me on tax cuts and got those through, but it's good you're going because we have a big disagreement on trade. That's how I read that.
Well, and we heard the word globalist a lot yesterday. I mean, we know sort of what that means. What does that mean?
Well, it means a couple of different things. I'm not the political expert, but obviously in some of the far right groups, to use the word globalist can be a slur for a Jewish person. And Gary Cohn has been one of the more prominent Jewish members of President Trump's cabinet. So when he mentioned that term yesterday, there was a lot of raised eyebrows about that. But I think more from an economics term, obviously this idea that that free trade is always the best trade. And that's been the mentality probably since the Clinton era. Some would argue even starting in the Reagan era, this notion that the U.S., we should try to sign more free trade agreements with other countries. And basically, the more trade we do, the better. There's been a lot of pushback on that, on both the Republican and in some Democratic circles, including Democratic Senator Bob Casey is a big supporter of these recent tariffs. There's a belief that we've gone too far in that direction, and that sometimes other countries are able to take advantage of these free trade agreements that they have with us by getting more favorable terms from us than we're getting from them.
I mentioned Paul Ryan in my introduction, but there certainly was a lot of pushback. I don't know if pushback is a strong enough word, from members of the Republican Party, from conservatives, from business executives, people that we associate with the GOP. Just how angry are they?
Oh, incredibly, incredibly angry. I mean, to see Paul Ryan that verbally come out on Monday and make that rift was a gargantuan signal to how deep this particular issue is dividing the Republican Party. The problem, though, is when I spent a lot of time going out around the country, to Pennsylvania, to Michigan, to Wisconsin, to Kentucky, to Ohio, to those Rust Belt states, and workers, certainly blue-collar workers there, like this. It's resonating with them, even though overall you look at the poll numbers and it's about 50-50 whether people support this tariff nationally. When you go to some of those key areas that Trump really feels are his base, people like it. I was talking to a Ford worker. Ford, the auto companies are going to get hit hard by this potentially, right, because they're big consumers and users of steel. Yet when you talk to the actual line workers, they told me, look, I see this as standing with my blue collar brothers. I want to see more of these jobs come back. I think that they agree with Trump's assessment on this.
Well, we're going to play a clip from one of those workers a little bit later in the hour, but they were standing next to the president yesterday. And to be honest with you, Heather, they told some really compelling stories about having their father, in many cases, working at these factories and their worry and what happens when someone loses a job like that.
That's right. I think one of the most interesting questions, though, that you should ask, and I have been asking around the country, is they want to save those jobs for them, for the workers who are there now. But if you ask a lot of them, do you want your child to work in that factory? That's when the answers get a lot more interesting. And what I tend to hear across the country, both from steel workers or from auto workers or other factory workers, is by and large, they don't want their child to work in it. They understand that the world is changing. They understand that those jobs are very hard on your body in some cases. And they would like to see their child or children go into what we might call more high-tech, white-collar jobs of the future. But nobody's really laid out a clear path
there. Sorry about that. We got to end it there. Heather Long, thanks so much for joining us on Radio Times. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. And we're discussing President Trump's action yesterday, ordering tariffs on imported steel and aluminum. Here's more from that announcement explaining why he made this decision.
The action that I'm taking today follows a 9-month investigation by the Department of Commerce, Secretary Ross, documenting a growing crisis in our steel and aluminum production that threatens the security of our nation and also is bad for us economically and with jobs. The American steel aluminum industry has been ravaged by aggressive foreign trade practices. It's really an assault on our country.
Trump accused other countries of dumping these products in the U.S., flooding the market, driving American companies out of business, and leading to layoffs. The head of the AFL-CIO said 52,000 steel jobs have been lost since 2000. This decision is a continuation of Trump's efforts to rewrite trade policies, something he promised on the campaign trail. And it was fiercely debated in the White House and Congress among economists, business leaders, and labor leaders, and criticized by U.S. allies. I should also add that yesterday, 11 nations, excluding the United States, signed the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal in Santiago, Chile. We have two guests who have joined us to stay with us for the rest of the hour. Josh Bivens is Director of Research at the Economic Policy Institute. Josh Bivens, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Edward Alden, and he's the Bernard L. Schwartz Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, wrote a book called Failure to Adjust, How Americans Got Left Behind in the Global Economy. And Ted Alden, nice to have you with us on Radio Times, joining us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C.
Good to be with you, Marty. Thanks.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me pick up on something that the president said a lot yesterday and was in that clip that we just played. He made this decision, these tariffs, based on national security. And Ted, if I can toss that to you, what is the basis for this decision based on a policy of national security?
Well, it's a very old law, Section 232 of the 1962 Trade Expansion Act, signed by John F. Kennedy. Hasn't been used really in a long time. The last investigation under this was in 2001, and nothing happened. So the claim is that imports are of large enough quantity that they are harming the ability of the United States to produce adequate steel and aluminum for particular needs of the Defense Department and for broader mobilization in time of war. Global trade rules do allow a fairly broad exception if countries say that imports are harming their ability to protect their national security properly. So that's the legal argument underlying these actions.
Josh, let me go to you and also to you, Ted, as well. And I think the question at the heart of the decision that was made yesterday is, will this bring back the steel and aluminum industries? Will this lead to more hiring of workers? Josh, what do you say?
Well, I don't think the tariffs by themselves won't do that. I mean, the hope here is that the tariffs provide, one, a little bit of breathing room for American steel and aluminum producers, and two, kickstarts a process where we have a multilateral set of talks that ends the problem of excess capacity in the global steel sector. The problem of this excess capacity in global steel is something that's been really widely recognized. The G20 recognized it. They set up a global forum to address it. The Obama administration recognized it. Nothing particularly useful has been done on it over the past couple of years. And so these tariffs are meant in large part to sort of really kickstart that process. If they don't, if all we ever have is these tariffs, or if they go away after a couple of years without addressing the more core problem, no, they're not a long-term solution. But they will provide some temporary breathing room and hopefully kickstart that bigger process.
Well, Ted, let me pick up on that. If we're talking about excess capacity, is that because of quote-unquote dumping? Is it because of production or productivity, I should say? Is it because of automation? Help us understand what is creating some of this excess.
The excess capacity is almost entirely a China problem. So China's output of steel has grown tenfold in the last 15, 16, 17 years since it joined the WTO. China produces roughly half of all the world's steel now. A lot of that is a result of heavy subsidies from the Chinese state, from the Chinese banking system, which have not been adequately constrained under the rules of the World Trade Organization. So the result of that is you basically have too much steel sloshing around in global markets. You can go after some of that narrowly under U.S. anti-dumping and countervailing duty laws. And in fact, the United States has done that. Steel imports directly from China are quite small. But to the extent that there's an oversupply, it drives down prices everywhere in the world. And certainly puts competitive pressure, not just on U.S. steel producers, but on those in Canada and Europe and South Korea, Japan, elsewhere in the world as well.
Josh, looking at the announcement that the order of yesterday, could the president have been more targeted at China in particular?
Yeah, that's definitely something people have raised. And I think the decision about how targeted to go, which I could be wrong in this. My sense is that's not finalized, that he left open the possibility for exempting some countries' steel from these tariffs, although he hasn't announced anything yet. I mean, the degree to which how tailored these are to only China, I think is really sort of a negotiating decision. I think the thought is we have this problem in global steel excess capacity. Countries, for whatever reason, even the ones that are not engaging in sort of the state subsidies and some of the market distorting actions, haven't gotten serious about addressing it. And so we're going to draft them, willing or not, into the effort to actually start pressuring the countries that are engaging in the market distorting subsidies. And the way we're going to pressure them is by saying, maybe you're okay with all this happening in the world, but you no longer get to sell at a preferential rate in the United States unless you join us in this effort to deal with the global excess capacity problem. Is that the right approach? I'm not positive. I think there's a little bit of logic to it.
Marty, sorry, just to weigh in, I think that's a misreading of what the president's done. I mean, there is a process, as Josh mentioned, to try to negotiate a solution to global overcapacity through the G20. The Trump administration rejected offers that China made through that process. I mean, I would argue that we should be working in cooperation with allies like Canada and Europe and Japan and South Korea to go after the China problem. Instead, this action hits only our friends. This has basically no negative impacts on the Chinese steel industry, but it hurts the European steel industry, the Japanese steel industry, the Korean steel industry. For the moment, Canada and Mexico have been exempted. But this is a very, very poorly targeted action by the administration.
Well, let me pick up on that because to you, Ted, and then to you, Josh, the president seemed to indicate or say yesterday that depending on what happens with the NAFTA negotiations that are going on, I'm not sure what he's expecting from Canada and Mexico, but they could, not have to live under these tariffs. But what do we know what that means, Ted?
Well, I mean, that's, of course, a ridiculous claim on its face, right? Because the rationale for this action is that imports of steel and aluminum are threatening national security.
Right.
If national security is threatened, then you don't put the tariffs on the bargaining table in NAFTA and say, well, if you help us in NAFTA, then we might be able to do something for you on steel. That's a traditional sort of trade negotiation. Fine, it has nothing to do with national security. So I don't think anyone knows what the administration really means here. There aren't exactly steel and aluminum issues directly on the table in NAFTA. There's a lot of issues surrounding the auto sector, which is obviously a big user of steel. But this was something the president threw out that I think we're all going to have to make sense of because it's not clear at all.
Well, let me pick up on that, Josh, and just slightly change my question based on what Ted just said there. But how would the auto or how will the auto industry be affected by these tariffs? And we should say a tariff is a tax. It's another word for a tax. But what do you see as the impact on the auto industry?
Yeah. So, I mean, just to circle back to Ed's point for a second, I sort of agree with that. Bringing in NAFTA and tying it to these tariffs, I mean, I'm not a trade lawyer, but it does seem to be conflating two very different issues legally and economically. It doesn't make a ton of sense to me either. So I would agree with that. On autos, I mean, yes, autos are probably the biggest users of steel and aluminum. And so if you're looking for sort of a upward price pressure effect from these anywhere in the economy, that's where you would like to see it. And so I think that explains in large part why you've got countries whose steel sector is being pressured by excess capacity in steel, and yet who have chosen to not really do all that much about it. You know, I think Canada is a really clear example here. Maybe their steel sector is pressured by excess capacity, but they have a large and politically influential auto sector that is thinking, this gives us pretty cheap steel. And so I think that explains some of the sort of failure to act on this by a lot of countries around the world, because you have those cross-cutting interests.
That's Josh Bivens, and he's director of research at the Economic Policy Institute. Also with us is Edward Alden, Ted Alden, and he's the Bernard L. Schwartz Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, talking about yesterday's executive order by the president imposing tariffs on imported steel and aluminum. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. times. Ted, I heard a report this morning on Morning Edition on NPR having to do with Brazil. And apparently the United States sells a lot of coal to Brazil. And Brazil uses that coal to make steel that then they sell back to the United States. Not the largest importer of steel to the United States, but nonetheless one of the several countries, actually right after Canada. What does that tell us, though, about international trade and just how things like commodities can cross boundaries back and forth?
Well, this is going to have different impacts in different parts of the economy. I don't think there's any question that the steel and aluminum sectors will become somewhat more profitable as a result of this. They'll probably expand capacity. They'll probably hire some workers back. But you're going to see negative impacts in other sectors. Coal may well be one, you know, exports for steel production. I think the auto sector, as Josh mentioned, prices will be higher. And so they'll be a loser from this action. Construction equipment makers like Caterpillar, the beer makers are complaining because the cost of beer cans are going to go up. So you know, these actions have different impacts in different parts of the economy. They create some winners and some losers.
Josh, who pays a tariff?
Well, directly, it's people who it's the people selling the import to the United States. It's collected at the border, and it pushes up the price at that point when it enters sort of U.S. production. I mean, in practice, eventually there will be an end user of the product that contains the steel or the aluminum, sort of someone buying a car, someone buying an aluminum can of beer, and presumably the price will be pushed up and hit that end user.
The end user meaning you and me.
The consumer. Yes, okay. Exactly. Anyone who buys
a
car
or can
that.
Beer. Let me read a tweet from P. Edward who says, I'm in favor of this. Whatever happened to the idea that Americans should be able to buy products made in America, like American-made steel? Longtime Bucks County resident, I remember when U.S. Steel Fairless Hills Works was still in business. It's been closed for a while. And there are a lot of people, Josh, I'll toss this back to you, that just are saying, look, we need to do something to bring back steel, to bring back aluminum, to bring back other manufacturing that seems to be hurt by a lot of these trade deals.
I mean, I'd say a couple things. One, I think we absolutely should do something to help U.S. manufacturing. I don't think you should look at these tariffs as anything like it's not a comprehensive strategy for bringing back manufacturing. They are pretty narrow. Steel and aluminum are not big sectors in manufacturing. These tariffs are really meant to solve a very specific problem in a specific sector. And I think they should largely be graded on those grounds. It is the problem of excess capacity in global steel. I feel like the issues in regards to U.S. manufacturing writ large are bigger. They're more about the misaligned dollar. And I would say just one thing. I mean, I think in regards to steel and aluminum, so it's absolutely true. Tariffs create winners and losers. You're going to see less pressure on steel and aluminum jobs over the next year because of these tariffs, but you're going to see some slight upward price pressure in steel-using industries. I would say those steel-using industries, though, have benefited a lot from excess capacity in steel over the past couple of years. They have had a couple-year run where steel has been very, very cheap, I would argue in large part because of market-distorting subsidies and our trading partners. And so from sort of a simple, you know, fairness point of view, it's really hard to be too upset that they're going to be facing higher prices going forward. You know, I would argue the equilibrium price of steel, the price that would exist if markets were fair, should be higher than it's been for the past couple of years. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think it's all that big a basis for complaints for steel-using industries.
Here's what concerns me, and it relates to your earlier point, Marty, about how interconnected we are, right? So if the result of this is that steel in American-made cars becomes more expensive, our tariff on imported automobiles is only 2.5%. And so if auto producers who are building their cars in Mexico or in Japan or in Korea have access to cheaper steel, their costs go down. Their exports of automobiles to the United States are likely to go up. And I think that probably becomes a net loser for the manufacturing sector. I don't think that's what the president wants to achieve, but that could well be the result of this.
Well, and let me just pick up on that. I don't know a whole lot about the auto industry, Ted, but my understanding is that cars that are being made cross the U.S.-Mexico border multiple times. Am I right about that?
I mean, it's in the North American production chain, particularly at the U.S.-Canada border. The industries have been integrated going back to roughly 1965, so they cross back and forth a lot. But and within NAFTA, you know, you've got tariff-free trade. So I apologize. Mexico was not a good example there. But if you're talking about cars coming from Japan or from Korea in particular, possibly eventually from China, which is moving into auto production, U.S. tariff on cars is pretty low. And so the cheaper price of steel in those foreign countries is going to give their car producers a relative advantage over North American car production.
Do you think, Josh, there will be some kind of a trade war as a result of this decision?
I mean, a trade war sounds a little too apocalyptic to me. I mean, there could well be some retaliatory tariffs from some of our trading partners. You know, traditionally, those kind of retaliatory tariffs have been at the scale of the initial tariff. So they will put on trade restrictions that are about the same in magnitude and size as the steel and aluminum tariffs. And I don't think those even combined are particularly large. I think if for some really odd reason it escalated far, far above sort of the initial magnitude of the tariffs, that could be a problem. And I would reiterate, I mean, if the net outcome of this is just these tariffs are here for the next 5 or 10 years and no movement is made on the problem of excess capacity in global steel, I think a lot of the problems being pointed to would actually happen. To my mind, these should be judged on whether or not they actually do kickstart a process to solving that larger problem. These are not sort of the long-run sustainable solution for what's going on in steel and aluminum. They are providing some breathing space and hopefully, we'll see, kickstarting a process to deal with those larger problems.
And we're almost up on a break here, Ted. I did hear coming from the EU, well, we're going to put a tariff on whiskey, on Harley-Davidson, on American blue jeans. Is that just talk or is that a threat?
No, I think that's a real threat. And I'm far, far more worried about this than Josh is. I mean, for the last 25 years, these trade disputes have all been conducted under the rules of the World Trade Organization, which means you only saw that sort of retaliation if it was authorized as a result of dispute in the WTO. The EU is threatening basically to ignore that process and to sanction the U.S. directly. Other countries could do the same. The amounts are not insignificant. The Europeans are talking about more than $3 billion. So I am worried. I don't think we're inevitably going to get there, but I'm worried we might.
That's Ted Alden, who joins us along with Josh Bivens. We are talking about President Trump's executive order yesterday imposing tariffs on steel and aluminum imports and apparently going to go into effect in the next couple of weeks. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Much to talk about after this short break. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Let me play something that Ron Davis said yesterday. He was standing next to the president when he announced these tariffs on imported steel and aluminum. And Ron Davis is a steelworker from Conshohocken, just outside of Philadelphia.
How you doing? My name is Ron Davis, steelworker from ArcelorMittal Steel in Conshohocken. Just wanted to say, in 2009, my plant supplied a majority of the armor for the Humvees and all the vehicles in theater. And it's sad to say, because all these imports coming in our country, our plant's going to be idled in September. So at one time, our plant had 400 members. We're going to be down to about 71. So these tariffs definitely have an impact, and maybe not for our plant, but for the other plants out there. So appreciate what you're doing.
Thank you very much.
And again, that was Ron Davis speaking yesterday, standing next to the president. Josh Biffins, let me get a response from you. And he was one of several steel workers who talked about the importance of these jobs to them. They also talked about their fathers, excuse me, working in these factories and what it means when someone loses their job. And these are real people with real jobs and real families.
Yeah, I mean, I think the pressure being put on the steel and aluminum sector, including jobs in those sectors over the past several years because of this problem of, you know, one, too much capacity in the global economy, and a lot of other countries doing things to prop up what might be inefficient plants. I mean, usually the way excess capacity in a sector is dealt with in a market economy is the least efficient plants go out of business. You've got some plants in the United States, many of whom might actually be efficient by global standards, who are still being forced out of business because we don't have the level playing field. And so I would say, on the one hand, yes, you know, we have a dynamic economy and displacements and stuff happen all the time, but the minimum I think we owe people is to make sure that displacements that happen and when plants shutter, that is because of sort of above board level playing field, at least level playing field-ish competition. And I don't even think we can, it's bad enough to lose your job, even if the rules were kind of fair, it's pretty devastating. But when you lose your job and the rules haven't been fair, I think that's sort of the minimum we owe people.
What do we owe people, Ted?
I get why these workers are upset. You know, they've been told for years now that, well, this is just the global economy and there's nothing we can do about it. The United States did not react seriously and aggressively to lots of evidence of Chinese cheating throughout the 2000s. Josh mentioned currency. The Chinese systematically undervalued their currency throughout the 2000s. There were a lot of ways in which China had very unfair advantages, and it hurt a lot of U.S. manufacturing workers. I mean, we saw a third of all U.S. manufacturing jobs, more than 6 million, disappear during the decade of the 2000s. So I think we owe those workers more defense, more proper defense through our trade instruments. But I also think that we owe them, real support when they lose their jobs, retraining, new opportunities, financial support if they want to move other places to pursue job opportunities, education and training for their kids to be able to move into other sectors. I think they deserve serious attention in a way that they just have not had. And you can understand why they're angry.
Absolutely. Let me get Mike from Philadelphia to join our conversation. Hi, Mike. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I work intimately in this industry in a family business that operates as a repair center. We used to do all kinds of coal and steel back in the 80s and 90s, but we've moved on, and the workers have moved on. I'm actually about to take a client out to lunch at a paper mill. They used to be coal fired. Guess what? Now they're natural gas. And a lot of the workers and a lot of the plants have moved on from this coal steel thing, and the infrastructure is no longer there. I mean, I've been to Bethlehem Steel. It's falling apart. I mean, it's a shell of what it used to be. If you put these tariffs in, where do you think the jobs are going to come from? You don't have those workers who are going to know how to operate these furnaces. I mean, this is serious, serious 12-hour shift work. Where do you think these people come from? They've moved on. They're now at natural gas plants. They're at chemical plants. They're at refineries. Like, these tariffs are going to go on for, what, 4 or 5 years? Do you think the industry is just going to reboot itself?
Well, Mike,
and all of a sudden we're going to have 10,000 jobs?
Mike, you raise...
This is all just a farce.
No. You raise a bunch of really good points. Let me give Josh Bivens a chance to respond to that. He's saying, essentially, in many ways, we have moved on.
I think that's half right. I mean, I would say it's absolutely true. Again, if all that happens out of all this is tariffs at the levels announced going on for 4 or 5 years, there's going to be very little. You're basically going to keep some plants that would have gone out of business over that time period from going out of business. There'll be a little protection that way. We're not going to see an actual sort of rebuilding of steel and aluminum capacity in the United States unless there's sort of a durable solution to the bigger problems in the industry. And it's the same thing with U.S. manufacturing. Ted mentioned earlier the problem of currency misalignment that has really disadvantaged U.S. manufacturers across the board over the past, basically since 2000. And I think, not only do we need to see a dollar that moves back down to a competitive level that actually allows our products to compete well in the global marketplace, we need a durable commitment that we're not going to allow it to get out of line for so long again that we're just going to hamstring the ability of manufacturers to export. We need to convince people that whether it's unfair trading practices or excess capacity or currency alignment, we are going to use policy to make sure that U.S. manufacturing actually competes on a level playing field. And it's going to take much more than just these tariffs. But again, if these tariffs kickstart one part of that process, addressing the problem of excess capacity, then we can begin to make that commitment, and you will see genuine investment in rebuilding the capacity of U.S. manufacturing and in the steel and aluminum sector.
Ted, let me try something out on you. What if the United States decided to truly invest in our infrastructure, in rebuilding roads and bridges? I think there's something like trillions of dollars worth of work that needs to be done. Would that be a better way to help steel and aluminum and manufacturing and the kinds of workers we've been talking about?
Yeah, no question. And I mean, it would also help the health and competitiveness of our economy, right? If we had, you know, rail systems that moved people and freight better, if we upgrade our ports so we can get our products to global markets more cheaply, all that stuff would help a lot and would create a lot more manufacturing activity. We've got to keep this in scale, though, right? You know, you go back to the 1960s, we had a quarter of American workers in manufacturing, and a lot of those were very well-paid union jobs. And I completely understand why the loss of those jobs is mourned. But we are now talking about an economy in which fewer than 10% of workers work in manufacturing. As Mike pointed out, a lot of them are not working in the old types of manufacturing. They're working in new types of manufacturing. Manufacturing is highly productive, very automated. It's going to get more so. I mean, where do we think the robots are going and are going to go? They're going to go into the manufacturing plants. So manufacturing is not going to be a big engine of job creation in the United States. I think it's very important. It's important for our technological edge. It's important for our national defense. But it's not going to create lots of great jobs for the next generation of Americans. We're going to have to look in other places for that.
Josh, the president yesterday mentioned the tariffs that were put on solar panels and also on washing machines. And he seemed to indicate, and those tariffs, I think, go back to January, so relatively recently, he seemed to indicate that somehow that has then revived domestic industry when it comes to those two products. I don't know if I was reading the president right or wrong there, but can we use that as a way to understand what these new tariffs are about?
Yeah, I mean, I would say, you know, as he typically does, my guess is he has strongly overstated what the evidence tells us so far, because those are relatively recent tariffs. The idea that they've clearly been a game changer for those industries already seems, you know, dubious at best to me. I mean, I think what is different about the steel tariffs, in my view, are a couple of things. One, I think the downward pressure on prices in steel and aluminum has just been ferocious in steel and aluminum for a long time now, and these tariffs will provide some immediate relief on that. And there is this larger issue that these tariffs can potentially help address of excess capacity. I feel like this is much more of a sort of two-step at minimum process to solve the problems of steel and aluminum. And so they just sort of they're potentially part of a coherent strategy that I think you could make pretty big claims on. Like, if we do this right, if we somehow use these tariffs to leverage a more global solution for the problem of excess capacity, I think you really could make large claims that this could be a game changer for steel and aluminum industries. And it's true. They're not sectors that are going to create millions and millions of net new jobs. But there are sectors that do employ lots of people and good jobs today, and they have been really pressured by unfair competition, and I think that is changeable.
Let me read a bunch of comments. We have here one from Eric. I support the government's promoting certain sectors of the economy. That is what smart governments do. An email from Janet. Don't healthcare costs for employees have more impact on industries leaving the United States? A question from Bruce. I heard that the reason for the tariffs was because of congressional by-elections to shore up union support. An email from Ian. What is the anticipated effect of the U.S. locations of companies of France and in Germany that produce aluminum both here and abroad? Just a smattering of opinions there. Ted, if I can go back to you, one of the other things that the president talked about is something he described as reciprocal taxes or reciprocal tariffs. Essentially, if you slap a 25% tariff on a product, let's say on a car, we'll do the same in the United States. If it's a 50%, we'll do 50%. If it's 10%, we'll do 10%. Is that smart policy?
Well, I mean, not really. And it's not the way the global trading system has worked for a long time now. I mean, these global trade agreements are a sort of complex balance. So there are places where the Europeans, say, have higher tariffs than we do on some products. Cars is an example. There are lots of places where they have lower tariffs. The United States has wanted a lot of other things through these trade agreements, you know, protection for intellectual property, for our, you know, for Silicon Valley and for pharmaceutical companies and for others. There's a lot of things we've asked for. So the notion of sort of one-on-one, your tariff is X and therefore our tariff is going to be X, is not the way this has been done for pretty close to a century now. I mean, there's no saying that you couldn't try again, I suppose, to do it in the old-fashioned way. But the world sort of moved beyond that post-World War II. So Trump's resurrecting a very old idea of how trade negotiations get conducted.
Let me see what John from the Philadelphia airport has to say. And John, go ahead. You are on radio times. There you are. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to comment. The previous caller had mentioned Bethlehem Steel and that the people had moved on. I mean, it was a tremendous pride aspect with Bethlehem Steel. It was the envy of the world. And I think, you know, from Trump's, position about putting tariffs, not so much from the financial, but from the psychological, like, let's get our pride back, let's get American Steel back, you know, let's win one for the Kipper. I mean, one example I can use, the Bay Bridge out in California that collapsed during the earthquake of 89, that contract, that bid was awarded to a Chinese company. And they had all kinds of problems with Chinese steel coming over with cracks and it cost overruns, et cetera. So I mean, what is your opinion on that?
Sure. I appreciate the call, John, to Radio Times. And Josh, let's talk about American pride and pride in American workers and American products. How important is that?
I would turn it around a little. I mean, I think one reason why I am encouraged by these tariffs is because I see them as finally trade policy privileging the interests of a blue-collar sector over some others. And I think Ted mentioned before, you know, over the past 20 or 30 years, a lot of what we ask other countries is essentially enhanced protection for our pharmaceutical and software sectors. Mm. And it's very odd to call these free trade agreements when, as part of the agreement, we are increasing protection for some very specific sectors. And at the same time, we freely lower our tariffs on industries that are very heavily populated by blue-collar workers. And so I think there really has been this feeling, and I think it's true, that sort of the rules of the game embedded in these trade agreements have been very tilted against typical American workers. Instead, we've protected pharma and software, and we've thrown steel and other blue-collar sort of workers into fierce global competition. I feel like this is a time when trade policy is actually being used to protect some jobs in a blue-collar industry. And so that, to me, is, I think, one reason why it's so resonant. I feel like people think the rules have been rigged against them for a long time in our trade policy. I think they're largely right about that, and this feels like a change in direction. Whether or not it's a durable one whose benefits are maximized, you know, we'll see. But I do think that is what is resonating so much to people about this.
What do you think, Ted?
Yeah, I mean, I would have to agree with that, but it does depend on what your vision is of the economic future of the United States. You know, old-fashioned steel, aluminum production are not the cutting-edge technologies that they used to be. I mean, if you're talking about national security and economic competitiveness, the high-technology industries coming out of California and Boston and other places are probably more vital. And that's a real kind of question of trade-offs. I won't argue with Josh. I mean, we gave away the textile industry, for example, hundreds of thousands of jobs in the Carolinas that were essentially negotiated away in trade arrangements. It would have been hard to save them. You would have had to have very high tariffs and quotas because other countries can make these things so much more inexpensively. Of course, it's great if you go to the Target or the Walmart, you get cheap clothing. But it really does have to do with your vision of the economic future of the United States, and that's a debate I don't think we're really having as a country. I do think that there's some nostalgia here, and you can't go look at the rusting hulk of Bethlehem Steel and not feel sad in some ways. But economies do move on and they change, and if you want to be a world leader, which I think the United States does, then you've got to stay on the cutting edge of the economies of the future.
We are going to end on that note. My appreciation to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times and making tariffs sound so interesting, and they are clearly important as well. Ted Alden, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot. Great to be with you.
Nice to have you with us. And again, he's the Bernard L. Schwartz Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, joined us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C., wrote a book called Failure to Adjust, How Americans Got Left Behind in the Global Economy. Josh Bivens, thank you for joining us as well.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And he's Director of Research at the Economic Policy Institute. And we began our conversation talking with Heather Long, economics correspondent for The Washington Post. Appreciate all those comments and calls to Radio Times. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times to find out more about the program. You can also download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, sign up for our newsletter, and listen to us on satellite radio. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trine Nuri. I'm Artie Moscoane. Thank you for joining us.